This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Many adults with mental illness in North Carolina end up living in an adult care home. And that's the kind of place usually reserved for the elderly. And homes like that don't typically offer mental health treatment, and most people who work there don't have any mental health training. There aren't many alternatives for mentally ill adults in this state, and that has drawn the attention of the U.S. Department of Justice. A federal investigation is underway to see if North Carolina's reliance on these homes violates the Americans with Disabilities Act. Meanwhile, North Carolina's neighbor, Tennessee, seems to have found a way to provide a variety of appropriate options for people who are mentally ill, everything from owning a house to living in apartments or group homes. Its success has contributed to a decline in wait times at Tennessee mental health institutions, and it has saved the state a lot of money. Joining us now is WUNC health reporter Rose Hoban. She recently completed a five-part series on housing for the mentally ill called North Carolina Voices, Mental Health Disorder. And joining us by phone from Tennessee, Bob Curry, Director of Housing and Homeless Services at the Office of Recovery Services in Tennessee. Welcome to both of you. Nice to have you here.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi, Bob.
Hi, Rose.
Rose, will you paint a picture for us of the situation in North Carolina? If you're mentally ill, you can't live on your own, where do you go?
Well, that's actually the issue, is that folks with mental illness probably can live on their own. Many of them, they need some training. So a lot of times they'll be discharged or about to leave a state psychiatric hospital. And there are few alternatives of places for them to go, and frequently they end up in adult care homes or family care homes, which are the similar licensure but smaller than seven people. And they don't get a lot of training to live independently there, and sometimes folks just get stuck. And by different estimates, there's anywhere between 5,000 and 7,000 people in adult and family care homes around the state in this situation.
So I'm leaving an institution. I have a mental disability. I have a mental illness. Haven't been given any training. I end up in this adult care facility. What can I expect there in terms of my life and treatment?
Well, folks are there because they need assistance with two activities of daily living, no more than two. So they'll get usually that's medication management and getting their meals. And then you'll have a place to stay. The adult care homes are not supposed to be providing mental health services. That's supposed to be provided by, local management entities for mental health in the state. And so, but you might have a whole home, or you might have a number of people in the home who have mental health disabilities, and staff really aren't well trained a lot of times. And there have been some unfortunate incidences. There were four deaths in about a course of a year of people. Three of the victims had mental illness, and the fourth victim was an elderly gentleman. And all four of the perpetrators were people with mental health disabilities.
They were homicides.
They were homicides, yeah. They were homicides.
And so you have what kind of services do they need? Well, typically, what would they be looking for that they're not getting?
Oh, God, that's a whole range of stuff. Anything from, life training, like, let's train you to take your own medication so that you could live independently. Let's train you to budget so that you could live in a home or an apartment and, manage it on your own. Let's get you some vocational services. And, and a lot of that stuff isn't coordinated. That's left to caseworkers and case managers and social workers within the mental health system. But there's very little coordination. So, somebody who's from Guilford County might end up in an adult care home in Durham County, in no small part because there's a lot of adult care home beds in Durham County.
Then would it fall to Durham County to provide the social workers or the professionals who would provide that service? Theoretically, they would go into that home?
If they knew about the patient. Yeah. A lot of times they don't know that the person is even there, but then something happens and then Durham is now responsible for them. That's a frustration of a lot of the mental health program managers like Ellen Holloman, who I interviewed for my series.
So how is it that North Carolina came to rely so much on these facilities that don't seem to be properly suited to take care of these folks?
Well, you know, I think it's an agglomeration of circumstances. You had a push to deinstitutionalize people during the instigation of reform in the early 2000s. There was a promise that there would be community services put in place. There was a trust fund that was created. And almost as soon as the ink was dry on that budget in 2001, it was a bad budget year. And Governor Mike Easley turned around and, you know, took 90% of the money or 85% of the money out of that trust fund. It never really made its way back in. And I think my impression from researching this over months and months was that, you know, the adult care homes kind of, they were the pressure release valve. They were there. And they were available, and there were owners who were willing to take these folks with mental health disabilities. And so there wasn't really a sense of urgency to actually go ahead and create a lot of community-based alternatives for folks. And I think it just perpetuated itself because there just wasn't that urgency. There wasn't the political will at the highest level in state government to say, no, it's time for us to build community resources. That it just wasn't there. It takes a little money up front, right, that, you know, that you can save money down the road. But all those things that just never came together.
They didn't come together. And it might be intuitive for us to say, well, this just doesn't sound right. But in fact, there is perhaps a legislative mandate behind this. The Disability Rights Act, Disability Rights of North Carolina issued a report that suggested it's more than just intuition involved here.
Well, I mean, there's two big things that they're resting their report on. One is the Americans with Disabilities Act, which is a very complicated piece of legislation, but it was reaffirmed by Congress in the 2000s, I think it was 2007. And then that was passed in 1991. And then in 1995, you know, ADA had all this wonderful high-flowing language about, you know, treating people in the most integrative settings in the community. Yeah. But then in Georgia, these two women in 1995 who were in a state psychiatric institution who their counselors said they were able to live independently, but there were no options for them. They sued the state of Georgia, and it made its way through to the Supreme Court, and that is, and they won. And the Olmstead case, which was decided in 1999 in the Supreme Court, basically stated that this institutionalization is a form of forced segregation, and it's illegal.
And illegal. So it's perhaps a violation here in North Carolina to rely so much on these homes. Bob Curry, in the course of Rose's reporting, she went to Tennessee and she found out that you have actually made some great progress in housing for the mentally ill. First, give us an idea of what the situation is like and sort of how many people we're talking about in the state of Tennessee.
In terms of
people... People who require housing, mentally ill adults, I guess.
Because our system is decentralized, if you will, the services are provided by the local community mental health centers who operate as private nonprofits. I can give you an estimate. It's probably in the range of 70,000 to 80,000 folks that are receive some form of mental health treatment. And or substance abuse treatment in the course of a year. They're at varying levels of need and care. Some of them require housing, some of them living independently in the community.
So tell us what the situation is like in your state. For do you rely on adult care facilities?
We generally have developed independent housing opportunities for people with a history of mental illness or co-occurring substance abuse. Starting in the year 2000, Marie Williams, who's the Assistant Commissioner for Mental Health Services, has actually started the program called Creating Homes Initiative. And while there had been some housing previous to that had been developed on the basis of by community mental health areas and community health centers and community health providers, there had been some developed before this time. In the year 2000, she began a concerted push to develop community-level housing. And since that time, we have developed over 9,800 housing opportunities.
What does it take to do this? Is it expensive?
The funds that we've leveraged to make that happen since 2000 are about a little over $400 million. but the state's contribution to that, the State Department of Mental Health's contribution to that, was probably less than 5%. Hmm. Most of the funding is coming from HUD, from our state housing authority, from Federal Home Loan Bank, from several other local resources, a lot of contributions, just a wide variety of different funding sources that have contributed to the various different housing opportunities.
Well, Rose Hoban, does that suggest that there's a lot of money available for this outside of the state treasury that simply hasn't been accessed? Nobody's gone and found this money.
I mean, that seems to indicate that to me. I think one of the, I was Bob and Marie hooked me up with some of their regional housing facilitators, and I got to go out into one of the rural areas of Tennessee. I went to Paris, Tennessee. They have their own Eiffel Tower. And I spent a day with Roseanne Downing, and she and I talked a lot about how she goes and looks for money. She's on a listserv that, you know, every time there's a federal grant announced, she gets an email about it. She goes out. She knows everybody. She covers 20 counties, and she knows people at banks. She knows people at you know, local foundations. And so they'll say, hey, there's this property that we'd like to develop. And, you know, we've got, you know, a little bit of money from the state, maybe a couple thousand dollars here. And could we get a couple thousand from you and a couple thousand from you? And then they call it layering. They just sort of layer all this stuff on top of one another. And then it means that a local, you know, not-for-profit can afford to buy a facility.
So if you're a little bit aggressive about finding the money, it can go a long way. And you did talk. This was Roseanne Downing you're talking about, regional facilitator in Tennessee, a housing facilitator. And she also talked to you about the financial benefits of looking for this money.
To provide support services for people living in housing that would help them get back out on their feet, averages $18 to $25 a day. And if you go into a jail, which is a lot of the people with mental illness, that's where they end up instead of the hospital, that can be anywhere from $50 to $60, $75 a day. You go into a private hospital, it can be $90 to $110, and our mental institution, it's $120 a day. So just the cost benefit for me as a taxpayer, it's a, you know, a fourth of the cost to help somebody to be independent or become independent and self-sufficient than it is to house somebody in a hospital.
So that's Roseanne Downing.
And she's in her car where she spends a big chunk of her day. I asked her how many miles she puts in her car a year. She said about 50,000.
Driving around Paris, Tennessee. Bob, is that the Athens of Tennessee, Paris? I'm sorry. I couldn't resist that. Tell me about the political, how this came about, Bob, because, you know, we hear Roseanne making the argument we hear so often. It will cost you so much less in the long run in terms of emergency care, hospital care, and the criminal justice system if you would just build this up front. Was that the debate in Tennessee? Was this a difficult political fight to make this happen?
When Marie came in, she had come from a background of working with HUD and so knew a lot of the HUD funding sources that were available and also the possibility of layering with other community resources. So she started off small and started working with the local, with several of the public housing authorities and developing community coalitions that were very much more broad-based than a lot of the mental health facilities, mental health agencies had previously, and found that there were a lot of people out there who were really wanting to find housing for these folks, that they were showing up in the criminal justice system, they were showing up in the healthcare system, they were showing up in the mental health system. And if everybody could get together and say, yes, we have a common interest in finding these people housing, that in fact, the housing could be developed. We did know where to go look for the money as long as there was the broad-based community support for making the housing happen.
And Marie told me that she's had the support of several mental health commissioners and three different governors, both Democrats and Republicans. So there has been the political, you know, backing there mm-hmm. for a decade.
Well, it sounds like she was able to make the case, and I wonder here in the state of North Carolina what it would take to do that. Is it a question of exceptionalism? You need that individual. Is there active resistance? Are there, for instance, interests that would be opposed to any kind of change in the system?
Well, I mean, that is something that I found. I heard from a lot of folks that there are a number of factors. The Adult Care Home Association lobby is pretty powerful. They're at the General Assembly all the time. There's also state bureaucracy. And like I said, there has been no sense of urgency. And what I'm hearing from folks now is that, oh, hey, you know, we've gotten this letter from the Department of Justice that they're investigating. And all of a sudden, there's like a little bit of it turned up the burner a little bit.
Well, I want to talk more about that, but I want to ask Bob Curry. We've heard a lot about the impact on the state. It apparently is saving the state money, and it's lowering the wait times for people who do need to get into institutions. What has been the impact on those who are mental illnesses in terms of their outcomes and the way they're living their lives since these changes have been put in place?
We have done some outcome studies on the people who have resided in the in the community housing opportunities that we've provided, and found that there was, comparing 1 year before they entered this community supportive housing and 1 year after, there was a reduction of about 90% in terms of the number of hospitalizations and a similar number of hospital days that the people experienced. Mm-hmm. So the community supportive housing does seem to be effective in terms of helping people stabilize in the community and keep them out of the hospitals.
This is the thing I heard over and over from people, too. It's this emerging consensus within the mental health provider community that housing is really the linchpin for people. And although sometimes you might think it's somewhat counterintuitive, to even take someone who has a substance abuse problem and get them into housing first, and this is what the movement is called, housing first. You get them into stable housing. Bob was with me. I went on this one interview with a gentleman, and I dropped my recorder, and it killed me because I lost the track. But he talked so eloquently about the fact that he'd lived on the street for 7 years. He had a bipolar disorder and a substance abuse disorder. And you never feel safe when you're living on the street. You don't know if you're going to wake up and someone's going to be holding a knife over you. You know, you have no idea what your future holds. So the idea of actually getting sober or, you know, dealing with your substance abuse problem on top of your mental health problem when you're like living in a shelter, and this is what we've been asking people with coexisting substance abuse and mental health problems to do for decades.
Well, Rose, in the minute that I have left, what are the there's a federal investigation now. Tell us about that and what are the possible outcomes from that?
Well, there was an investigation that was similar to this in Georgia, and it took 2 years. So we're at the beginning of it. And the folks in Georgia, the state, is being compelled by the federal government. They came to a settlement and they're being compelled to spend $77 million to house more than 7,000 people with mental health disabilities. And they're doing it at a rate that's probably faster than they would have done it otherwise. But they're being forced to spend money right now in a very difficult fiscal environment. So, you know, in my stories, I said that, you know, it won't matter to the Department of Justice that lawmakers here say that we're in a fiscal crisis. We're a little lucky because we're probably a good year away from a settlement.
Well, and it sounds like if you don't take the time to develop those networks and find those other funding sources, you're going to have it all on your back rather than do what Tennessee has done, which is to develop other sources and find ways the state money leverages.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I want to thank you both for being on the program today. Bob Curry is Director of Housing and Homeless Services at the Office of Recovery Services in Tennessee, and Rose Hoban is WUNC's health reporter. She recently did a 5-part series on housing for the mentally ill. It was called North Carolina Voices, Mental Health Disorders, and of course you can go to our website and find that, WUNC.org. Just ahead, Playmakers Rep Company is putting on Joan Didion's play, The Year of Magical Thinking. We'll have a preview on the state of things after this. Stay with us.